Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Let's see, what year did this come out? I know you don't want to hear this, but
62? 63?
Yeah, so I was seven.
Yeah, well, you're reading more Forrest J. Ackerman than you are me. He completely rewrote it and used words I didn't understand.
Well, maybe so, but you know, I wrote all those titles down in a little notebook, and that was my to-view list for many years. So even though it was at 40, it was you, I thought.
So just because we do record, we're recording now, right?
He's holding up. First, he held up an issue of Famous Monsters of Filmland that printed a letter that I wrote and turned it into an article.
Number 18. Yeah.
And now he's holding up
a DVD of Infested,
which is the movie that Josh never talks about.
I try not to talk about it.
You know, I'll also add, this means I'm talking to the only two people to direct Zach Galligan starring vehicles. So,
well,
is that true?
No, there's Douglas Hickox and there's some other people.
But I've never been in a room with someone else.
Oh, with two people who have directed Zach.
So, yes, you know, I'll tell them.
Both did direct Zach in starring roles. So.
We saw Landis the other night after he did the show, and he walked up to me and goes, "I didn't know you had directed a horror film." So now he's watching it, and
the word's going to get around. Let's face it.
There you go. But I also am a fan of History of Violence as well.
So. Ah, thank you.
So proving he is eclectic in his likes.
This is The Movies That Made Me, with your hosts, Josh Olson
and Joe Dante.
Well, I guess we might as well. Let me walk through. I mean, you've heard the show. I do these kind of half-assed introductions, and I just sort of grabbed a bunch of things I wanted to mention, building up to my huge intersection with you. I remember first seeing your work in Heavy Metal magazine back in the day, and you did. In fact, we talked about that. Joe, you weren't there. There was a Masters of Horror dinner the other night.
I was there.
Joe left early. He had other things to do.
I left before Quentin showed up.
Yes, you did, which which meant you got out before the sun rose, because he and Landis just squared off and just went on. And somehow this came up, but we were talking briefly about the graphic novel of 1941.
Oh yeah, the Steven Spielberg film. Yeah.
Which I maintain is better than the movie. Do you know the graphic novel?
I have not seen it. No.
It's astonishing. Oh.
Joe, I'll send you a copy if you'd like.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to.
Rick Veitch and I were hired by Heavy Metal to do the graphic novel of 1941. We had to steal the shooting script because it was a co-production of Columbia and Universal, if I'm remembering correctly. And the rep from the production showed up at the Heavy Metal offices and didn't trust us with the script. Our job was to spend the next 3 months of our lives adapting it, but I don't know what they thought we were going to do. We had to steal reference. It was quite a crash course. And then Spielberg hated it when we were done. He called it a Hieronymus Boschian nightmare.
It is. He's completely right.
Cannibalistic Hieronymus Boschian.
Even nightmare. Better. Yeah.
So did this get distributed?
Yeah, I bought it. I was a kid.
Yeah. But it was also a career lesson. Like within a month, it was on the blow through shelves in the chain bookstores.
Once
the movie tanked, that was the end of the graphic.
I will have I shoplifted it the day it came out, and that and the Animal House graphic novel thing were the two greatest, I think, movie artifacts of that era. But yeah, you were responsible. You created the magazine, the anthology magazine Taboo, from which sprang From Hell by Eddie Moore, Alan Moore and Eddie Campbell. Also better than the movie, I would say. You've got some new sketchbooks coming out from Spider Baby Graphics, a monograph on The Brood, big horror guy here. Don't worry, I'm going to say his name. Joe's giving me the look.
No, I'm sure by now.
You've got a video piece on the New American Horror Project 2 box set coming out from Arrow, and a new, coming out in a couple months from DC Vertigo, an absolute giant hardcover collection of the series that, as a kid, I was just getting to the point where it was time to stop reading comic books. This was a different era, and it was mostly superhero stuff. I had discovered underground kind of independent things and liked that, but I was getting close to not going to the comic book store anymore. And somehow, it's a long, long story. Not worth telling. I had intersected with the artist Bill Willingham, and who came into a store and I think I was even telling him I was getting sick of comic books, and he said, "Oh, you need to pick up this new comic book DC's doing. Remember Swamp Thing?" And I think I bought like the second or third issue that you guys had done. I was hooked for life. It's now 1,000 years later. I'm still reading fucking comic books. It's your fault. but we have
really forced you, Ackerman, drew all those.
But the artist of Swamp Thing, of the great Alan Moore run of Swamp Thing, we have Stephen Bissett here. Who my life got so fucked up because of what you guys did. Genuinely, I mean, I loved horror comics. I read reprints of all those EC things. But Swamp Thing was the first time I ever read a comic book that was fucking scary. It was scary.
What issues did you first get exposed to, Josh?
The one where I remember first just going Kazart was and in fact, I stole the idea very early on. One of the first scripts I ever wrote was the underwater vampire one.
Oh, yeah.
And that page where it's a series of panels of kids in the background on the surf or on the shore, while in the foreground you see this kid in the water, just his head. And it's a series of panels and the kid's head stays the same, but he's getting paler and paler and paler in every shot. And you turn the page and there's water, a giant panel, just one page panel from underneath, and it's vampires sucking all the blood out of his legs. And it scared the shit out of me. That was just amazing, amazing work. So,
and that issue was actually drawn by Stan Walk.
Let's get him. Okay, we're done here.
But I co-plotted that issue. Okay. We were trying to do a monthly comic, and whenever I would fall behind, you know, Karen Berger, our editor, would orchestrate a fill-in issue. That was the one issue where I was being punished. I started turning in pencils, but they weren't quick enough. So Stan Walk actually drew that issue. And the punishment was I had co-plotted that issue with John Tottleman and Alan Moore. So it did feel like punishment.
I feel like a complete
part two. I did draw part two of that water vampire.
Oh, okay. Good. Cause I feel like I'm interviewing Jack Kirby and I just talked about my favorite Herb Trimpe story, which.
No. Stan Walk did a great job. And that's not me dissing Herb Trimpe, but.
No.
I'm proud to be confused for.
Okay. I'm going to edit all of that out.
Anyway.
Oh, and I also, and years later, I was at Comic-Con. I used to go before it became a movie thing, and you were doing a panel or a session. You were on your own. And I thought, oh, let's check this guy out. And it was a history of horror comics. And I thought, oh, this will be fun. He starts, tell me if I'm wrong, with 12th century China.
Yeah. 12th century Japanese ghost scrolls.
It's a Japanese. I am so sorry.
And the Hungry Ghost Scrolls.
And I walked in, and I was just like, oh, my God, this is amazing. That was an incredible lecture.
And that's why I'm teaching today. James Sturm, who co-founded the Center for Cartoon Studies, I'm going into my 15th year teaching there. He saw me give that talk at an academic gathering in Bennington, Vermont, at Bennington College. And after the talk, James said, "I need you." And that was the beginning of the career I never thought I'd have. Now I'm a teacher.
That's fantastic. Oh, yeah. Obviously, you're great at it. So thank you so much for coming on. We have a previous guest, Robert Kraskowski, writer, director of The Man Who Killed Hitler and then the Bigfoot, or as I call him, Bob Hitler Bigfoot. And I mentioned to him that you were coming on, and he lost his mind. He was just he couldn't believe how fortunate we were to get you on this thing. So thank you for joining us. How's that for a rambling introduction?
It certainly was.
And I wish we had time to talk about some of the movies that made you, but
can we?
Oh, I suppose. I suppose we can squeeze in a few. Right. But you're here. You want to talk about?
Yeah, I took your title literally.
Okay.
And I put together a list of. I tried to think through the movies that actually shaped, you know, the path I ended up taking as a storyteller, as an artist, and writer. So, if you guys are up for it,
that's what it's all about.
It's gonna be scary.
I'll start by saying, you know, I never got to see the 7-hour movie orgy. I hope before I die, I will get to see it.
You'll get to see the 5-hour movie orgy. It's been whittled down since then.
Okay. If there's ever a way to see it. And I also guess I should take off the table right off the bat Walt Disney movies, because like everyone in, you know, Joe's generation, my generation, and probably yours, Josh, you know, I mean, the Disney films were formative influences, the animated features, but also, you know, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. That was a huge,
big deal. Big deal.
Yeah.
But I got to take those off the table, because then that would be all we're talking about. And that's not really accurate. And I'm also, there's a few others I'll take off the table by mentioning, if you'll indulge me.
you're going to take them off the table by putting them on the table?
Well, I'm going to put them on the table to knock them off the table and get to the important ones. Like, there were certain movies like The Brain That Wouldn't Die that just never stopped being shown on television and so became important just because I couldn't get away from it. And there were also films that I only saw parts of when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. Like, we used to, Joe, you've talked about this a few times on the show. Like, it used to be if something was on television, that was the only chance you were ever going to have to see it, you know?
Yeah.
So there were a lot of odd films that I only saw pieces of that had a huge impact on me, but I can't really put them on the table because I only saw parts of them. Like, there was this Canadian film called Le Petite Aurora. Have you ever heard of it? The Little Aurora?
No.
No.
It was made in Quebec, like in 1952. And it's this infamous Quebec case about a little girl who was abused to death by her stepmother. And it used to show on late night Canadian television. We would get Channel 6 out of Toronto, Channel 12 out of Montreal. Those were English. And we got Channel 10 out of Montreal, which was a French station, and it would pop up on there, and I would actually sit through it in French because it was this little horror movie about this sweet, innocent little girl who is abused to death by her stepmother. And the stepmother is electrocuted at the end of the film. So that's a movie I can't really say I saw as a kid because I don't understand French, but I saw it as a kid.
But it affected you, right? Those things would seep into your...
Yeah, and it really, I think it was, it, I think I stuck with it the first time because the whole score is an organ. So I thought it was a soap opera. And then the abuse of the little girl kept getting more and more extreme, like putting her hand on a wood stove, tearing her hair out. I mean, just horrible stuff. And then there were films that I only saw pieces of, like.
Well, it's called Le Petit Aurore, L'Enfant Martyr. French is directed by Jean-Yves Bigras. We are starting out with a win.
And it, like I say, it used to be on French, you know, Channel 10, uncut. And then there were some that I only saw pieces of, like The Sadist used to be shown on television under a different title.
Face of Terror.
That was it. Right. I thought it was Profile of Terror.
Not that too.
And I only saw like the last 45 minutes of it. And I thought it was a cop show or a crime show. And it scared me shitless. I mean, it was terrifying. And then it ended. And I looked in the TV guide and there was no listing for any such movie. Right. Like something else had been scheduled in the TV guide.
Oh, wow.
I didn't even know what I had just seen.
That's an amazing performance, too, from who's
Arch Hall.
Arch Hall. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's one that I didn't catch up with again until I think Johnny Legend and Rhino put it on video.
Yeah.
And that may have even been one of your prints.
I think it was my print.
And that's when I finally got to see the movie. But that was, you know, 20 years after I caught the last 40 minutes of it on television.
Now on Blu-ray, I believe.
Now it's on Blu-ray.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then there were weird things like Cape Canaveral monsters.
Oh yeah.
Wow.
Which is
Phil Tucker. You know,
by the, right. Phil Tucker. And that movie really haunted me as a kid. Again, I only saw a part of it, but it was the part where they're talking about the male alien infested corpse has just lost its arm. And the woman played by Kathleen,
Catherine Victor.
Catherine Victor, Jerry Warden's.
Jerry Warden's squeeze.
And she's like berating him because he's lost his arm. And again, I didn't know what movie it was, but I stuck with it to the end. And that haunted me for years with my not knowing what it was, you know, Cape Canaveral Monsters. And I only caught up with it again, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago when I found a bootleg of it.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I don't know.
That's a weird movie.
That is a weird movie. And another one was The Intruder, the one with William Shatner. I saw about an hour of that when I was a kid. I didn't know what it was. Again, I thought it was some drama. I mean, it plays almost like an episode of Route 66, if you see it out of context. Mm-hmm. What it is. And it was listed in the TV guide under a different title. I think Shame.
Right.
Yeah, the KKK one.
Yeah, Shame and I Hate Your Guts.
And that's an amazing movie.
It's an incredible film. It's a great movie. It's the movie that made Roger Corman not make serious movies anymore.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Is it really the one movie he made that made
The one movie he made that made no money.
Yeah.
It wasn't just that it didn't make any money. He couldn't get it booked. Nobody would play it because of what it was about.
Which do you want to give you? I mean, it was.
Well, he took a small crew down south and he shot this based on a book by Charles Beaumont about a guy who's a rebel rouser based on a real guy named John Casper who used to go down and foment a lot of trouble and race riots.
Yeah, exactly.
And so William Shatner, in one of his better performances, plays this guy. And they had to go down to different places down south and shoot pieces of the movie before they found out what the movie was about. And then they would move. Yeah. They'd have to go somewhere else and shoot more stuff. And they had a big speech, a big rabble-rousing speech that he gives, which they had. He says one thing when the camera's behind him, when there's an audience there.
Oh.
And then when they turn around, he says stuff that if he said in front of those people, they would.
This is a beautiful town you have here.
It's really a terrific movie.
Oh, it's so good. And then he tried to distribute it. It's a savage indictment of racism in the South in the 60s. And he tried to distribute it almost exclusively to drive-in movie theaters in the South in the 60s.
Well, he sold it.
Yeah, film group, right?
Yeah. Yeah. He made it. It was made for his non-union company, but it was made for Pathé Industries, and they booked it in New York. It got some reviews. Nobody went. And then he sold it to a guy named Mike Ripps, who was an exploitation guy. And Mike called it I Hate Your Guts.
Trash.
Yeah, he's the poor white trash guy. And Mike called it I Hate Your Guts, and he played it in, you know, drive-ins and grindhouses and all that. But it was really kind of a lost movie.
Amazing film.
About 20 years ago.
Worth seeking out. These are just the ones you're taking off the table, though. So
yeah, this is an off-the-table movie.
I want to put on the table to not.
We won't talk about it.
Is the I went with some relatives when I was a preteen, and I believe we were in Pennsylvania because my relatives had an accent that didn't sound like Vermonters, right? And they told our parents we were going to see one movie, but the movie we actually went to see was 2000 Maniacs at the drive-in, and I. You know, we were shell-shocked as the film went along, and I was also terrified that my relatives were going to kill me because they sounded like they were Southern to me. The movie, right? So I just remember sitting in the back seat of their car, like traumatized by this film, which is a movie I now love. I think it's Herschel Gordon Lewis's best film.
That's saying something.
So many to choose from.
Beginning, middle, end, and it's very effectively put together. But I didn't know I was safe until the moment that our oldest relative, who was the one in the driver's seat, the teenager with the license, turned around and said, "We're all making a promise right now. We're not going to tell any adult what we just saw." And I don't even know what the second feature was. We left at the end of the movie. So I guess I could say 2000 Maniacs, you know, made a huge impression on me, but it didn't really feed my creativity. It just traumatized me.
Well, there's something to be said for that too.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
There is. So, Okay, so now I'll start, if you're okay.
These are not on the table movies. Those movies are just finished
on the table movies. I grew up with a holy trinity, again, thanks to television. And I'll name all three. And this was the holy trinity because our local TV station, which was Channel 8, Portland Spring, Maine, had these films in their, you know, the package of features that they had leased. And they would show them again and again, so I could watch them again and again. And it was The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms,
mm-hmm.
the 1940 Thief of Baghdad, mm-hmm. and Gordon Douglas's Them. And those three movies are like my holy trinity. Like, those three movies taught me how to tell a story, the power of fantasy. You know, Beast was my gateway drug to every Ray Harryhausen film ever made after that I could get even near. And Eugene Lurie's films. From the time I was a little kid, you know, I would try to remember the name that would come up on the screen for the director and the writer, and I would try to find those movies. So thanks to Beast, I saw Colossus of New York, The Giant Behemoth, Gorgo, and even movies like Crack in the World that Lurie didn't direct, but he worked on. So those were like that's the holy three to me, those three films. And I would only see them in black and white because we only had a black and white TV.
Sure.
Growing up. So I didn't really see The Thief of Baghdad in color until, you know, I was in high school. And that was revelatory to finally see it in color. And Thief of Baghdad is one of those movies I go back and revisit like every 3 or 4 years. I find it's a film that as I get older, it changes. I change. And where, you know, Conrad Veidt's character was the villain when I was a kid. Now that I'm in my 60s, it's like, you know, Conrad Veidt's onto something here. You know, unrequited love, and how do you make the person that you love you? You know, I just think those three films are like magical for very different reasons.
Mine of those is Henry Higgins, terrifyingly. I find him less unsympathetic every time I see that movie. That's a terrible thing to say.
You mean My Fair Lady?
My Fair Lady, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
He's still an awful person. I want that out there. He's a terrible person, but not as awful as he was when I was a kid. But do you find, because, I saw all those on TV too. I saw them all black and white. I saw them out of sequence.
God, I saw them all in theaters. I'm so
You old. Saw them all? Well, I'm wondering if...
Thief of Baghdad was a matinee. Yeah.
But there was something about seeing, especially the Harryhausen stuff as a kid.
Oh, yeah.
Without any idea what it was, with terrible reception... Often with the sound turned down really low so
you wouldn't wake your parents.
No one would know I was up and watching TV, let alone monster movies. That I don't know. Joe, you found them in theaters. Did they grab you the same way? Because to me, they were so illicit.
Well, when Them came out, Beast of 20,000 Fathoms had been an independent movie that Warner Brothers bought. And it made a lot of money for them. And they had a big campaign. And it involved lots of pictures of people running around with little balloons coming out, like, oh, it's big, you know, and it's terrifying.
It's alive.
It's alive. And so when they made Them, which was a picture that Jack Warner didn't want to make, but they made because the previous picture made so much money, they sold it exactly the same way. The ads for Them and the ads for the Beast are almost the same ad, except one's got a dinosaur and one's got giant ants. But as a kid, and it was also tremendous use of television advertisement, for that, in that picture, it was really, you couldn't, no kid in town didn't know this picture was playing. But it was a very scary movie in 1953 because it was an atomic movie.
Right.
It was about, the last line of the movie is like, you know, if this is what's happened since our atomic tests in 1945, you know, what's the future going to be like? And, yeah. You know, it gave you a healthy skepticism about authority figures and about science and mostly about radioactivity and all that stuff. And I think that those atomic fear movies really pushed my generation into what happened in the 60s.
Mm.
Because Three Mile Island is just a culmination of all the stuff that we had been afraid of when we went to see those pictures.
Yeah, yeah. And they were reinforced that, you know, I was going to a little one-room schoolhouse in Duxbury, Vermont, but we were still doing the duck and cover.
Oh, we were too. Yeah.
You know, yeah. And that just made those films feel even more, you know,
relevant on
the present and scary. Because by then, you know, by the time you're in grade school in the early 60s, you knew getting under your desk just meant there'd be other radioactive dust on top of you from your torch desk. Well,
you're going to die under your desk. That's so funny. I had this memory from the 80s, New Year's with some friends one night, drinking a lot, doing other things, and we watched First Blood and Them as a double feature. I have no idea why. And then proceeded to stay up all night long, having created new rules for Risk. Do you remember Risk, the game?
Oh, yeah,
the game. Where my girlfriend at the time had invented a version that was nuclear, where you could have a nuclear bomb. And we then added every army got one Rambo that you could drop behind enemy lines and could take out, you know, 10 soldiers. And then we felt if you were going to have nuclear Risk, you also were running the risk of developing giant irradiated ants that you could not be controlled.
That so every improves the game enormously.
It did. It, well, it also made it go all night. But every time you dropped a bomb, you then had to roll to see if you got the giant marauding ants, and they would. It was a lot of fun.
You know, I also have to say them is so well written that I think that's the film that taught me how to tell a story. Mm. And rudiments were there in The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, but Them and a few other films that were in the local TV package, like Rodan the Flying Monster, the early Toho film. You know, you set up a mystery.
Yeah.
It's almost plays like a police procedural until that moment in the desert in Them when the sandstorm's happening. You actually see the first giant ant after you hear it. I mean, the way they teased out the impossible situation of giant ants and then made it seem so credible to you.
You're right. It's a model of how to make that kind of picture. And yeah. It was such a model that it was copied endlessly over and over. But the weird thing is that approach, that mystery approach is what makes the movie great. And yet every single person going into the theater already knew.
You already knew
what the mystery was. And for the picture to still work after the audience already knows what they're going to see. And still be interesting and still be suspenseful and still have good characters is quite impressive.
It is. And I'm still, you know, it had a huge impact too that here's a spoiler alert for those of your listeners who don't know, James Whitmore buys the farm in that movie. And right. It was such a shocker that one of our two heroes, you know, doesn't make it out. And it's still a powerful moment when I revisit the film today.
Also, if you want to, if you're a James Whitmore fan, or even if you're not, if you watch him in the film, he has the most subtle ways of stealing a scene throughout the picture. I mean, his performance is very naturalistic, and I'm sure he didn't, after doing, you know, Asphalt Jungle, I didn't think he probably thought of this as a plum assignment, but he's really good in it. And he has so many little ticks and movements and you know how actors sometimes
he's like the American Peter Cushing.
Yeah, exactly. Props, something. Always right. Doing something with props. Yeah, no, he's quite fun to watch just on its own.
Yeah, and it makes his character endearing. Now there were three other movies that I also saw on television growing up that I got to mention. One of them, and I think you guys have talked about it in one of your shows or at least touched on it. It was a movie that played under two titles on TV. I first saw it as Reign of Terror, but it was also The Black Book.
Black Book.
Stan Mann directed it.
Oh yeah. Well, you have Black Book fans here.
You have big Black Book fans.
And this is going to sound stupid to people, but it's true. It was like there was this little packet of French Revolution movies that involved crowds waiting for the guillotine blade to drop that would pop up on television again and again. But Black Book was the one I would always watch over and over. But it was like this little subgenre of sort of bogus French Revolution movies.
That one's amazing.
Josh had not been aware.
Joe turned me onto this recently.
Of this one.
Do you know there's a Blu-ray coming out?
There is a Blu-ray coming out from Kit Parker. And it's one of the best shot.
Complete.
Well, it's John Alton, who is great. Working with Anthony Mann, who is great. Designed by William Cameron Menzies, who is great. You know, and the screenplay is by Philip Yordan, who occasionally is great. So
and they have no money.
And there's no money, but the way that they use the fact that there's no money is remarkable. I mean, the use of rear screen projection of that movie is amazing. Oh,
yeah. And also shadows and doorways and
tight close ups of
it's a fabulous movie. And of course it has Richard Bessard as Don't Call Me Max.
Yeah, he's Robespierre in that. He also, and this made a huge impression on me. He gets shot right in the face.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they showed it, or you thought you saw it, the way it was staged. And that stuck with me as well. I remember my mom dragging me to Gone with the Wind. You know, when growing up in the 60s, you would get dragged to these four-hour movies like The Ten Commandments. They were like ordeals to sit through when you're 10 or 11. But Gone with the Wind also had a soldier shot in the face. And I remember thinking, oh, that's like that guillotine movie.
well, see, that's even something like Gone with the Wind had moments of pleasure for people like us. Just that moment.
People like us.
The other two that I would see a lot as a kid, one was Night of the Hunter, Charles Laughton's only directorial film. And I just think that, I mean, that, I choke up at the end of that movie every time. Just Lillian Gish with her little pious soliloquy sitting in her chair brings tears to my eyes every time.
It's a it's a great movie, and it's a tragedy that Lawton never made any other pictures because this one was such a flop. But when you think about how could it not be with that plot, you know?
Yeah,
And I saw that picture at a kiddie matinee.
Oh my God!
And with 10 cartoons and Night of the Hunter. And I'll tell you, I mean, it was
first run.
It stayed with you. I mean,
hey kids,
the scene where he chases the kids out to the boat, and then he's in the water, and then he screams, and it turns into this musical note. It was electrifying. I mean, there were kids crying. I mean, it was really a big movie.
That's Night of Living Dead stuff for '68 back in '55. Yeah. So, and that also got me into reading Davis Grubb's novels. He's one of my favorite novelists. He wrote the novel Night of the Hunter is based on.
And Fool's Parade.
Fool's Parade was the other film I was going to mention. That's one of my favorite movies from the drive-in era. I had my license by then, so I could go see it at the drive-in. And Fool's Parade was one of those movies that would come back at the bottom of the Dusk to Dawn show, and I'd go again to see it.
I don't know it at all. What?
It's James Stewart.
It's wonderful. It's Jimmy Stewart as a one-eyed... a one-eyed convict who's getting out of jail and he's collecting a check. They've held money that's somehow his. I can't remember off the top of my head. And there's a backwoods sheriff who's going to take it. And Jimmy Stewart is traveling with this ragged group. It's Kurt Russell when he was a teenager and the great Strother Martin, who's obsessed with the store they're going to open. So they're like scrambling across this junkyard, and Strother Martin is picking up empty cans and going, "We must carry this brand of peas in our store." it's just a wonderful film, Fool's Gold. Fool's Parade. I'm sorry, Fool's Parade.
Andrew McLaughlin, director.
Oh yeah!
Wow, I'm.
It's a great one. Fantastic. It's a great one. It's a really fun movie too. Great characters, and the third in that particular trinity was Robert Aldrich's Attack.
Oh yeah. Another picture I saw when I was a kid.
No
in a theater
shit.
At a Saturday matinee. And when Jack Palance gets his arm run over by a tank.
Oh,
let me tell you.
Oh yeah, that
a lot of squealing in the audience. No, don't do it.
Oh yeah. And then it gets worse. He shows up at the top of the stairs with his arm in shadow. You're afraid he's gonna step out of the shadow and you're gonna see what's left of his arm. I grew up in a military family. My dad served in four branches of the service. So I grew up, you know, seeing a lot of Westerns and a lot of war movies. And Attack was the one that stuck with me because my dad hated it. My dad was so angry at the end of that movie. And for me, that movie galvanized every fear of the military I had already been, you know, had already been embedded into me by growing up in a military family. It just confirmed for me, I never am going to join the service. These guys are idiots. and that got me into not only Robert Aldrich's films, but a lot of my favorite directors, Anthony Mann, Don Siegel, Bud Boedischer, Sam Fuller, Larry Cohen. I felt like Aldrich sort of introduced me to that whole very pragmatic, very male approach to storytelling in films. And Sam Peckinpah, of course, I would have to list in there. But it all started with seeing Attack as a kid. Just incredibly powerful movie. And it's also about adult corruption, but the way it's dramatized, even as a kid, I totally got it. You know, I totally got that Eddie Albert was the most present, dangerous adult, but that Lee Marvin was even somehow worse as the laid-back commander who just keeps his hands clean. He knows how badly it's going to go, and he's just going to steer clear until it plays out. And these were really strong adult concepts to have, you know, fed into your heart and brain when you're a kid. That's just an amazing movie, I think. So
and not as well known as it should be.
No, I think Attack should be required viewing. You know, everyone talks about Kiss Me Deadly, which is an Aldrich film I love, but I think Attack is just an amazing piece of work. And as a kid growing up with war comics, I mean, Jack Palance is playing Sergeant Rock in that movie. I mean, that's essentially the beginning of Easy Company and Sergeant Rock, only it's if things really had gotten bad.
Right.
So those are kind of the ones I grew up with. And then the horror films, because horror movies are what really shaped me. The first Mario Bava film I ever saw was Black Sunday. And that opening 4 or 5 minutes, I mean, that just, I had never even thought things like that could be portrayed on the screen. And you kind of get lulled into it. There's like this witch trial going on and Barbara Steele is tied to a stake. And then they bring up that mask. And you see the oiled, muscled
right. It's been so long.
Oh, no. Yeah. But the weird thing about Black Sunday, and the reason I want to mention it, is it not only was my gateway drug to all of Mario Bava, and I think Bava's had a bigger influence on me than any filmmaker other than Sergio Leone, is that it was the most religious film I'd ever seen. And I was raised Catholic, and so we were force-fed, you know, the greatest story ever told and King of Kings. I never felt religious from those movies. But Black Sunday was such a convincing dramatization of evil threatening to overtake everything. And then it's all swept aside at the end by the bond between these two people who barely know each other, and the nominal hero and Princess Asia. To me, it was this really spiritual movie disguised as a horror show. And it really, I found it profoundly moving. And I didn't see another film that affected me that way until I was 17 and I saw The Devils, Ken Russell's The Devils, which I also think is a profound spiritual religious film.
Yes.
But
yes.
Like Baba's Black Sunday, it's like you've got to go through that corporeal nightmare of the corruption of the flesh and you know, what forms does evil take in our world before you arrive at, you know, I can't even say good triumphant. It's just, to me, those, you know, Black Sunday was the first religious film I saw that really hit me in that primal way. So there you go. And I saw it on late night Channel 6 Canadian television. Channel 6 on Monday nights had a show listed as science fiction theater. They would show the films complete, uncut, no commercials.
Wow.
So my first exposure to Black Sunday was, you know, it was the AIP version, but it was vivid, you know, it was really vivid for me. And to start watching at midnight was perfect.
Yeah, somehow I doubt they would be running The Devils in that slot.
No. The Devils, until I think it was 73, it came to Burlington, Vermont. I had my driver's license by then. And The Exorcist was the big new movie, but it wasn't going to play in Vermont because they were rolling it out city by city. So one of our local theaters in Burlington said, prepare yourself for The Exorcist with The Devils. Because when The Devils had come out, I was 16. I wasn't allowed to see it.
Sure.
It was rated X when it first came out.
Yeah. I can't. No, that still never, is. It never played on TV. Did that ever play on TV anywhere?
It might have been on the CBS late movie and I like a chopped up like version.
The Devils? Oh, my God. Joe, they used to show strange stuff on the CBS.
They did. Some very odd things.
That's such an amazing film, and I agree with you. It's I hadn't thought of Black Sunday that way, but that makes sense. I mean, the way it's always fascinating to me that you know, for movies that are reviled as being so sinful and so evil, that movies like that can have an effect on someone like you. They do to me too. I think The Devils is a profoundly religious film. I'm not someone who's moved by that. I thought Last Temptation of Christ was the first movie I had ever seen that, as someone who was raised without religion, made me go, oh, that's a real story. This is a real interesting guy. These are the films that get condemned that actually speak some kind of profound truths to people. But to get to those truths, you have to walk through some very ugly territory.
I also think Black Sunday shaped my approach to storytelling, because Bava's films, they often won't make linear narrative sense. Yeah.
Do they ever?
Kill Baby Kill is all about sort of fracturing any linear narrative approach. But everything in Black Sunday made visual sense. Like I understood every time I saw it, like visually that narrative worked cohesively and perfectly. And there were moments in it. I mean, there's the moments people talk about in Black Sunday, but for me, it was things like those shots of dead Asya's face when her eyes are swelling into the sockets. You know, it's like, it's this physical feeling of resurrection that culminates in that great scene of Javuto climbing out of the grave. I still think it's a brilliant movie, even with whatever lapses you might find as an adult watching it now. I just think it's an amazing movie.
Joe just looks happy right now.
It's like he's reliving my childhood.
Good. Well, and a lot of these films, as I get older, I read about in Castle Frankenstein, and then later I found out, Joe, it was either you or Bob Stewart who'd written the reviews that had me tracking down those movies. So
it was a good thing. It was not for naught.
No.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
It was not. So then I'll have to talk about a few more. Horror of Dracula was my introduction to Hammer films. And I think Horror of Dracula is still just a brilliant movie. From the first shot, opening credits, and that score, that musical score comes on, I am in the grip of that film and those characters and that story, and right to the way it ends. I mean, I just think that's like a perfect horror film, particularly for that era in the late 50s when Hammer was first hammering that stuff out, pun intended.
Is that, this is where we get a lot of hate mail, because I'm terrible at this stuff and I really enjoy those movies, but that's the first Christopher Lee one, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I should know
first
this.
Hammer
doesn't talk.
Hammer decided to do. No, he talks.
Oh, what's?
Dracula's quite eloquent.
No, at first they decided to change their modus operandi and try some science fiction with the Quatermass pictures, and they did that, and it was successful. And then they wanted to make a Frankenstein picture in black and white, as they had been doing everything else in black and white, and through a whole lot of machinations with Max Rosenberg and Milton Subotsky, who had a version of the story that they didn't make. They came up with The Curse of Frankenstein, which was made in color, and it was pretty gruesome for the time and got horrible, horrible reviews particularly from the British press. It was like they just thought it was the worst thing ever. But it was very popular in America and was made with some of Seven Arts' money, and Warner Brothers had some money in it. So they followed it up with Horror of Dracula, which I think is the best one of those pictures from that period. And partly it's because they knew their limitations. They knew they couldn't afford transforming into bats and all this other stuff that was going to be too expensive. So they simply wrote it into the story that when Professor Van Helsing is doing his dictation, he explains the stuff that they can't do. They can't turn into wolves. They can't. Right. They can't turn into bats.
They can't turn into myth.
This right. is a myth, you know. But
doesn't he in later films?
Not sure, that, but not their films. I don't think they ever did. They. I don't.
Not
think,
in other Hammer films.
They had. I don't think he became a bat. There was a bat in Scars of Dracula, I think, but I don't think of those films as those are separate from Horror of Dracula, which is its own unique piece by itself. Everything about it is the ending is great.
Amazing.
And the score is fabulous. It is beautifully photographed. It's really well acted. And it really surprised a lot of people who thought that horror movies were mostly junk. And it started to get good reviews. It started to have these quotable reviews. This picture is really good. And that sort of, I think, upped the level of movies that were going to be made about that subject after that.
Yeah, I don't think we would have had the Roger Corman, Richard Matheson Poe cycle without...
No, I think the Hammer success is really what started it all off, because AIP was making two black and white movies for double bills, and when Roger finally went to them and said, let's make one in color instead and have it be good. And,
right.
And that was because of what had been... And you know, supposedly, one of the reasons that Hitchcock made Psycho was because he saw the William Castle movies making a lot of money.
Yeah,
You know, and it was like, well, wait a minute, I can do that, you know, and I won't have to spend a lot of money doing it.
Yeah.
And it was also films like, you know, Clouseau's
Diabolique, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, which only in retrospect did I find out had really been quite a success in the foreign release circuit and even bled into mainstream theaters.
Well, yeah, because there's a dubbed version that was playing and it was a popular movie.
I didn't get to see Diabolique until my late high school years. I went to a college showing of it at University of Vermont, and I was sitting next to this statuesque blonde. You know, here I am, like 17, and I'm sitting next to one of the most stunning women I've seen in my life up to that point. And at the end of the film, when he gets out of the tub, she dug her nails into my arm until my arm was bleeding, and I didn't care. It was made the ending even better. Go ahead.
I was just saying, I'm thinking about it here while you're talking, because I love the Hammer films and I have multiple import box sets and I think the thing is, I realize I saw so many of those the first time on TV in that truncated coming in half an hour late, leaving 20 minutes early.
Yeah.
So Christopher Lee is my Dracula. You know,
well, this is
but they all kind of blur together finally.
No, this is the one. You really don't need to see the other ones. Yeah, I think he would agree, by the way.
Yeah.
Well, and there's things I love in the later ones as well. I mean, the later ones I saw in the theater as they came out, but Horror of Dracula is the one that I got to see repeatedly on television. We had a color TV set by then, so I got to enjoy that aspect of it. And even when it was cut, I didn't care. It still worked, you know. They would usually cut the spatters of blood, the staking, and, you know, frames out of the meltdown climax, but the movie still works like a juggernaut for me. So, and another film I got to mention is Gorgo. I loved Gorgo. Like Gorgo, you know,
How old were you when you saw Gorgo?
When I first saw Gorgo, I was 8. And
coincidentally, there's an 8-year-old boy in the movie.
And he's Irish.
They knew what they were doing, Joe.
And it was the perfect dino movie for a dino kid, because Gorgo's mom wins. You know, you're so sure as you're getting toward the end, they're going to kill him. Nope, she wins. It was just like my heart soared at the end of Gorgo, and it does every time. And I also loved those Charlton comics that followed Gorgo. You know, Charlton had a writer named Joe Gill who was scripting the comics, and it was always Gorgo and his mother. They just want to eat and be left alone. And Steve Ditko drew about half the run. And then,
oh, wow, really?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Wonderful Steve Ditko art. But also these artists who signed their work, Montes and Bach. It was Montes, and Bach was Bache. It was a penciler inker team. And I loved all the Gorgo comics. That was the one taste of a franchise I got to enjoy as a kid growing up. You know, seeing Gorgo the movie, and then I could still pick up the comics on the newsstand.
But you probably weren't exposed to the Gorgo paperback.
I was. It was the dirty paperback that was.
Yes, you have talked about this.
Monarch Books.
Monarch Books and their filthy Monarch adaptations. Books,
what they made these deals with these companies to do these novelizations, and I'm not sure that the people who actually paid them ever read them.
Well, Sidney Pink did because he sued them for Reptilicus.
Well, which is Sidney really Pink. Filthy.
Oh, it is. It's a completely pornographic novel, you know. Well, for a 1962, you know, novelization of a monster movie, it's pornographic. But
the Stranglers of Bombay one is particularly dirty, I remember.
Really? Oh. Because that movie is suggestive.
Yeah. And the Brides of Dracula, it's the other one.
Actually rapes a woman.
Yes, I know. And apparently they were inspired to have him rape somebody in a later picture because of that book.
Because of, right, Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed. Yeah, I can see that.
I'm on Amazon. I did not realize this. The Ditko issues of Gorgo
are collected.
Yeah, in hardcover.
Yeah. You need to pick it up, Josh.
Script by Joe Gill. Good
but
God.
You need the Gorgo paperback more.
I've looked for some of those there. They go for choice amount.
And they all had a particularly odd smell. There was something about
all printed in Derby, Connecticut.
And there's something about the ink that they used, which was you could, and I'm sure these were, they probably also did pornos in addition.
I'm sure.
Well, no, actually, you know what they did that made a lot of money for them is Charlton's Bread and Butter with those Song Hits magazines, right? That would publish the lyrics of the top 40 songs. That was their bread and butter.
Really?
It was a mob-owned publisher. And their bread and butter were the Song Hits magazines, crossword puzzle magazines, and then on the side they did the comics and those Monarch paperbacks. So, Monarch paperbacks are amazing.
I always thought it
was the only dirty paperback I didn't have to hide. I could just leave it on my shelf. <Right. laughs>
Nobody knew,
right? So.
Speaking of Charlton, I want to say I always thought someone should try to do something with their superhero characters. That would be fun.
They did.
I'm kidding.
Okay, all right. So then there were three French films I grew up with I got to mention. And again, this was because two of them are because of Channel 10, the same channel I'd seen Le Petit Aurore on. And one of them, though, was because of educational films that would be shown in the classroom when we were kids. So the two I caught on TV were, I was flicking the channel dial around when you didn't have remote, when you had to physically get up, walk to the TV and turn a dial. And this face appeared on the screen of what looked like a werewolf, this beautiful werewolf. And And I sat back and I saw for the first time most of Jean Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast.
Yes.
And that Jean Marais creature in that, the Beast, I mean, is what grabbed me. And I was probably 9 when I first saw it. And I watched it in French. I didn't understand French, but it didn't matter. I mean, I was just, I knew the fairy tale, of course, from reading, you know, the little golden book of Beauty and the Beast or whatever. And that movie was my doorway into French films. I also caught our late night TV show out of Burlington, Channel 3, showed Horror Chamber of Dr. Faustus. Which is Georges Franju's Eyes Without a Face. And I loved it. And I only knew of it because of that Castle of Frankenstein spread, right? And there was that full page shot from the press book that said, you know, it's like a cross between Tennessee Williams and I don't remember what the other thing they named in the promotion. So Eyes Without a Face had grabbed me. And then on Channel 10, 2 weeks later, it was on in the afternoon. So I watched it in French because I had just seen it in English. And they got to the surgery scene, and it kept going. The one that had been shown on Channel 3, he starts cutting around the face, and it goes to a commercial. This kept going until he lifted the skin off her face. And this was the moment when I realized two things. A, they're hiding shit from me when they show these movies. And B, this movie is one of the greatest things I've ever seen because it really... you know, really got into the marrow of my bones. That's just a really beautiful and disturbing movie.
Yeah.
And the other French film, because of classroom showings, was one of our English teachers in seventh grade showed us an Ambrose Bierce short film called The Mockingbird. And I'm watching this, and I realized that I recognized the actor who's the Confederate soldier, that he was in the occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge that had been on the Twilight Zone. And it's Robert Enrico's Ambrose Bierce film, which was released in France as a feature, A Cour de la Vie, In the Midst of Life, which was the name of the Ambrose Bierce short story collection the stories were taken from. And it was three of those stories. It was The Mockingbird, which is about these two brothers who grow up and they teach this mockingbird to whistle a certain tune. And this is the framing story of a soldier, a Union soldier on watch at night. He hears something, he shoots. And then the next morning he goes to find the body and it's his brother. It's his twin brother that he had taught the mockingbird to sing. And he hears the song at that moment. And then the second story was Chickamauga, and it was a story of a little deaf kid who wanders from his home, and there's just been a battle. It's, again, a Civil War story. And this little kid starts playing with the soldiers who are all wounded. They're trying to crawl to a stream, and they're covered with blood, and they're dying or dead. And this kid is riding them like they're horses or playing with them like they're clowns. And then at the end, he leaves the battlefield and he goes to his home, and his home is burned down and his mother's dead. The battle had moved on while he was playing and he's lost everything. And then the third story was the occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, the one that, you know, won an Academy Award, that Rod Serling showed on the Twilight Zone. And the reason I'm mentioning it as a classroom thing is I saw the films out of order, and I saw the credits at the end of Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge when it was shown in an English class 2 years later. And the credits listed the other two stories, only it was the French titles, Mockingbird in French, Chickamauga. And that's when I realized, oh my God, this was a single movie. This was like Dr. Terror's House of Horrors.
Right.
It was the Ambrose Bierce stories. And that's a lost film. It came out briefly on DVD in France about 5 years ago, and they botched the release. The stories are out of order, and there was a manufacturing glitch with the disc. So I bought that Robert Enrico set that just came out in French on DVD because I wanted to see The Adventurers, which you talked about, yeah. Joe, during, you know, one of the trailers from Hell. And they had the shorts on there.
As shorts.
Yeah, just the three shorts. So I've got a friend who's kind of putting it together for me into a DVD-R so I can watch it again as a feature.
The feature was released in New York because that's I did see it in New York.
Really?
Yeah, in whatever year that was.
63 or 64 is when it played in Europe.
It's the same year that it was used for the Twilight Zone.
Okay, 63 then, yeah. I think. Yeah. And what did you think of it?
I was a huge Robert Enrico fan already. I really like his work, and I was very taken with it. Chickamauga particularly is really very unusual. And the use of natural sounds and his composer that he always uses, it's really a movie that should be better known, but it's kind of hard to find.
I'm hoping that you know, a label like Arrow Films or one of them will rescue it, because that one release out of France, unfortunately, I got to watch it once on the disc, and then it wouldn't play anymore properly. So it was like. Planned obsolescence. So that's one I would recommend to your listeners if they can find a way to see it. I love Enrico's films. Everything from, you know, A Cour de la Vie up to The Old Gun.
Yep.
The Old Gun. The Old Gun.
It's a terrific movie.
That is so hard to find, but so worth trying.
It's out.
Is it out? Oh, wonderful.
It's out. A terrific
that movie. Used to be so hard to find.
No, it was. Everything's hard to find until you can find it.
Until it's not. Yes, exactly.
Now I'm halfway through my list. Should I stop?
Holy crow.
Are you serious?
I'm gonna eat up all your airtime, but I'm halfway through my list of the movies that made me.
Well, cut to the bottom. Cut to the bottom.
Maybe we should cut to the Well, we got a little time. We can give a little.
I could just run through the titles and I'll keep going. this is a movie I caught on TV, and I know it's well known now, but when I caught it on TV, it was late night TV. It was not listed in TV Guide, and it so blew me away that I did something I'd never done before or after, is I grabbed my notebook and I wrote down the whole film. Because when I looked in the TV Guide and in the newspaper, there was no listing for it, and I thought, I won't believe I saw this movie if I don't write it down. And it was Carnival of Souls.
Uh-huh.
Herbert Harvey, Carnival of Souls. And the fact it wasn't listed made it even more magical somehow? Like, did I hallucinate this movie? But I knew I hadn't because, you know, I was wide awake and I just watched it. And the next morning I went into school and I tried telling a couple of my best friends about it and they didn't believe me. One of them actually went home, checked the TV guide, and came back the next day.
See, you're making it up.
You're lying. You made that up. And one of my friends went so far as to, because he was Twilight Zone literate, he said, oh, you must have just seen that Hitchhiker episode and you fell asleep and you dreamt this movie. And then, you know, it never got mentioned in Monster magazines until Calvin T. Beck's review of Night of the Living Dead in Castle Frankenstein. And he didn't talk about Carnival Souls. He just sort of offhand said, you know, this was influenced by movies like Invisible Invaders, Carnival of Souls. But just seeing the title in print was like, ah, vindication.
Right. Yes.
And then when I was in college, I went to college at Johnson State College in Johnson, Vermont, and I seized control of the student film program in my first semester because I realized they had money and no one was using it, right? They would blow their budget bringing in Jesus Christ Superstar. Who needs to see that? It's in the theaters right now. So I booked a whole film program and I went into there were all these 16 millimeter catalogs, like budget films. And they had, one of them had Carnival of Souls for $10 rental. So I rented it. We showed it on campus and people loved it. We ended up showing it three times that day because the word spread. I just saw this great movie. You know, people would do bongs and smoke pot in their room and come back and say, can you show it again? And I love Carnival of Souls. I just think it's this brilliant one-off movie. It's sort of like Night of the Hunter. He never made another feature, Herc Harvey. Mm-hmm. But, man, that movie just really worked for me. So
how do you I haven't seen it in a long time. I haven't seen it, but I always think of it sort of in conjunction with Night Tide.
It's similar.
They're very tonally similar.
But Night Tide actually had a distributor in this picture. Supposedly had a distributor. I saw it in Philadelphia at a really low-down theater in a terrible neighborhood on a double bill with The Devil's Messenger.
Oh, and they were both Hertz Lion.
Yeah, both Hertz Lion. And it was fascinating. You know, I mean, it's much of it is student film-ish. But
even that works on this really sophisticated level. I love that sequence when she's alone in the church playing the organ. And Harvey begins to intercut things like not just the stained glass windows, but like the altar boy's robes, you know, shifting in a little breeze that's going through the rectory or something. And then the camera like drifts to that amazing pavilion on Salt Lake and goes into the pavilion until you're zooming in on the face of the man in the water, the character Herc Harvey plays as he opens his eyes and she wakes up out of this sort of waking dream she's in. There's moments like that that transcend a sort of amateur or underground filmmaking, and it really, you know, takes me somewhere else, and it took me somewhere else at the time. Yeah. I think it also kind of prepared me for seeing my first underground movies in a weird way.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That makes sense, you know? Yeah,
that makes sense.
Then I already mentioned The Sadist, and thank you for reminding me. It was Face of Terror. I couldn't remember what title was on it, but, I mean, that film... I think I saw that around the same time I saw Carnival of Souls. And with what I saw of The Sadist, I could tell it was happening in real time. So it had an entirely different cinematic impact on me than Carnival of Souls had. And I always thought of those two together, even though they're light years apart. They were made independently, roughly the same year, with almost no means. The Sadist is what? A junkyard and five, six actors.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's just a brilliant movie. And then later I realized when I finally got to see the whole thing, thank you, Joe, thank you, Johnny Legend, I realized that Vilmos Zsigmond was part of the chemistry of that.
Oh, right, yeah. Oh, yeah.
The way that movie is shot is just amazing, you know? If I haven't shown my colors yet, you know, I'm a child of the 60s. So Bonnie and Clyde, I mean, seeing Bonnie and Clyde in the theater, and I saw it on its first release when it was getting terrible reviews, and I loved it. I thought it was just an incredible movie, and it took, I think Warner re-released it with a new campaign.
Well, they did because, you know, people came back and started taking a second look. And of course also because, you know, the kids, bless them. Starting to talk about it and see it and all that. I was excited to see it because I was a big fan of Mickey One, which was the picture that Arthur Penn and Warren Beatty had done earlier.
Which I didn't get to see until about 6 years ago. Yeah,
well, it was a seminal movie if you were in college, believe me. I mean, it was like, God, this is what I want to do with my life. But that, and then of course, you know, Bonnie and Clyde was, it became this tremendous cultural event after being essentially thrown away, because another picture Jack Warner didn't like.
Well, and I remember the audience I saw it with, there were maybe six of us in the theater.
Yeah.
I was dropped off by a relative to see it because I asked to see it and they had no adult discretion. So they dropped me off to see it. This is before the ratings existed. So there wasn't anything in the ads that made it look, you know, dangerous. And that was the gateway drug to all of the Arthur Penn films. I mean, I loved everything from The Chase to Missouri Breaks. I just think Penn was just a phenomenal filmmaker throughout that whole period. And Mickey One was the one I had the hardest time tracking down. It was almost impossible to see for a long, long time.
Yeah, it was.
Did you like it finally?
Say again?
Did you like it finally when you saw it?
I loved it. I love Mickey One.
I have never seen it. I am sitting on the, is it Arrow, I think, Blu-ray that came out a little while ago. It gets such a bad rap that every time I sit down to watch something I haven't seen before, I look at Mickey One and then I go, so you guys are the first people I've heard to.
Oh, no. It's
wonderful.
First of all, you should look at my Trailer from Hell review on our own site, by the way.
Is that a website?
Easily available for free. But it's like it's like jazz. It's an American new wave film, and that's what got the bad.
Oh, what am I saying? No, actually, you're.
It's absolutely like jazz. That is okay. It is. Jazz.
I actually think it was Joe's commentary that inspired me to buy the Blu-ray. Now that I remember,
but not to watch it.
But I need that extra push to watch it. I will do it.
Track that puppy and put that in. Make the time.
If you're a Herd Hatfield fan, it's a picture for you.
Oh well, I wish you'd said that earlier.
Penn had an interesting career because some people loved his, you know, like he had a huge hit with Little Big Man and Bonnie and Clyde ended up being a huge hit. But when I first saw Missouri Breaks, I thought that was one of the best Westerns I've ever seen. I dragged friends to it and it has these moments. Like I love that little soliloquy that Harry Dean Stanton has about why he shot his dad, you know? and I don't know where you guys are with Missouri Breaks, but man, I
like it a lot. Yeah. I saw it as a child. My father kept taking me to wildly inappropriate movies and was left mystified by it, as I was by, you know, Nashville and every other goddamn thing he took me to. But
sure than Nashville, at least.
He took me to Nashville three times. I love the music. But I went back finally when it came out on Blu-ray several years ago, and I watched it again. I was like, holy shit, this is... Forget my reaction. I was a child. Obviously, it wasn't for me, but I don't even understand the panning it got. I mean, it's unusual, but
it wasn't what they expected from those stars.
I guess
it was about Nicholson and it was about Brando.
Yeah,
yeah. Who
this
are both
is not
great.
The movie we thought they would.
They are so good at it.
But to me, those stars were about not knowing what the next film was going to be.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
Think about what Nicholson was doing, not just as an actor but as a director with like Ivy said and
going
Brando,
south.
You know, he was never. I think the thing I'd seen him in before Missouri Breaks was Burn, which is a brilliant movie.
Yeah, amazing film.
The Italian film.
Yeah.
So to me, you know, I would go to their films not knowing what it was going to be, and that was the fun of it. I had no expectations.
Yeah, exactly.
Then I got to mention Leone. I mean, I grew up in the 60s. I know the James Bond films were big. I did see them all, but it was A Fistful of Dollars for a few dollars more. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and Once Upon a Time in the West. That to me was the essence of cinema, were those four movies. And I had to take a bus to Montreal to see Once Upon a Time in the West because it wasn't playing anywhere around where we lived, but it was playing in Montreal. those Leone films, I mean, they changed everything about how I understood stories, how I understood film, how I understand the power of the image, the power of the close-up. If you're looking for it, you'll see a lot of the flavoring of that in my comics work. I even copped the lettering that they used, that the United Artists promo department used for Fistful of Dollars and for A Few Dollars More for all the Swamp Thing story titles.
Oh, that's wonderful.
You'll see titles, you'll go, oh, now I recognize that lettering font. It's I called it the Leone font. I don't know what it really is, but
you know, all those Dollars pictures were released in America the same year.
Yeah, 67. I was 12. Yeah. 12 and 13.
And oh, that Festival of Dollars was several years old already. And they had already made a sequel to it, which also hadn't been released. You know?
Right.
And then United Artists just said, wait a minute. But this could be a James Bond thing for us.
That's it. I remember those posters that didn't, the man with no name is coming, or right. They were just like a pistol, a sombrero, a hat. But the movies came through in spades. And those got vilified. Those were panned. The critics hated them. I still remember one of the New York critics misquoting Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. He says at one point a character says, gangrene is eating my leg and my eye. And I'm reading it going, no, he says not my eyes. Right? But they hated those movies so much. And they didn't seem like overly violent films.
They hated the concept of European Westerns. They were offended that the Europeans would be making Westerns.
Right.
And it's a good thing they didn't see the Carl May Westerns, because those
then if they did, they would have given the same reviews.
But they were also upending the sort of American perspective on those things.
Well, it was the James Bond influence was that they were anti-heroes.
Right.
When the first James Bond movie came out, Dr. No, the fact that he could shoot people and it was okay was a huge deal.
Yeah.
It was a big deal. But then if we said, it's okay, President Kennedy reads them, so it's okay.
Yeah, right.
I just want to plug, if we're talking about Sergio Leone, there's an Indonesian filmmaker right now called Muli Surye, who's got a movie called Marlena, the Murderer in Four Acts. I don't know if, have you seen this yet? You can see it on Amazon Prime. It's, I don't want to, her use of widescreen and just her visual sense. I saw it, and the first thing that came to my mind was Sergio Leone. I had absolutely stunning visual sense. The movie's amazing, but worth checking out. Just gorgeous, but reminds me of Leone in some ways.
For me, growing up in the 60s, really the two key filmmakers for me, I've got to count Ray Harryhausen, because he's my hero, and he was my hero as a kid growing up. But Bava and then Leone were sort of the two gods for me of visual storytelling, everything about their films worked for me. Even their strangest movies really worked for me. Maybe not Dr. Goldfoot and the Girl Bombs, but... you know, the rest of the Bob.
That's not his fault.
I know that's not his fault, right? And there was also something I learned later in college that I wanted to mention, which was when I went to Johnson State College, I was there to study art. I was hoping to do comics, but it's a little college, 500 students. You're a freshman. The seniors get all the art classes. So I ended up having to take theater. And I'd done a lot of theater in high school, but I didn't want to act anymore. So I got into tech theater, and I was handed... our textbook, which was A Method of Lighting the Stage. It's written by Stanley McCandless. He was a Yale professor, and he wrote this book in 1932. And I'm reading the book for my homework assignment, and I'm realizing this is where Mario Bava got his aesthetic for lighting, for use of color and lighting. And McCandless laid out this theory that you've got to use color, alternating colors from two sides, to fully present the actor, not just as a dimensional form on the stage that won't look flat, but also to communicate emotion to the audience. And all I could think of was some of the Bava sequences where characters are walking down a corridor and it's red on one side of their face and it's green on the other side.
Right, sure.
And it was like, oh my God, Bava's like, he had taken McCandless' theory from the 30s and he had taken it so much further with his films. And that also got me revisiting all of Bava films. While I was running the film program at Johnson State College, I rented every Bava film. I think we did the first Bava retrospective. It would have been in 74 and 75, because almost all his films were available on 16 millimeter, except the really oddball ones, like Dr. Goldfoot and the Girl Bombs.
And the Westerns.
Yeah, you couldn't see Fort Alamo film.
Do you have the Tim Lucas book?
I do. I contributed a bit. I was the guy that had the ads for Carnage from the Boston showing of what became Twitch of the Death Nerve. Tim's a dear, dear friend of mine, and I love that book. And I mailed Tim my ads that I'd saved from the Boston Globe and Boston Herald saying, here, you need these more than I need them, right? Yeah.
All right, let's end what's the book?
The Mario Bava. All the Colors of the Dark.
Yeah. Just want to get the plug in there.
And it only weighs 800 pounds.
Yeah, if you drop it, you could kill a pet.
Don't drop it on your foot.
Or your pet.
Also, same time the Leone films were hitting, I saw 1 Million Years BC, and I think Don Chaffee is a really underrated director. And I said this in print in Video Watchdog, and I'll say it again. That, to me, was the Dr. Zhivago of monster movies. I still love 1 Million Years BC, the Hammer remake. I just think it's a wonderful movie. And it's got this amazing, epic, romantic sweep to it. The fact that Hammer and all the filmmakers involved took it seriously when it would have been so easy to make this ridiculous movie, that was almost as important as the Leone films to me. And that may sound crazy, but
Akita. Akita.
Akita. Akita. At one point, they actually use a Greek word. When the turtle is coming up on the beach, Raquel Welch goes, Archelon, which is the Greek name for that species of turtle. So a little bit of Greek in there, too. Then I saw a movie. We saw a lot of movies in high school that they would show at local colleges, and we would get a ride out there. I saw a movie called Dutchman.
Oh, was Al
Freeman Jr.
Al Freeman Jr., yeah.
And Shirley Knight.
And it's Anthony Harvey's first film.
Mm-hmm.
Man who directed A Lion in Winter with his next film. And Dutchman was this scathing. It's only an hour long, and it's another lost film. I mean,
now on video, I believe. You can now get it.
Legally?
I believe so.
It came out once on DVD from Image in 2000, and I bought it when it was out, and it was out of print within about 3 months.
Tell people about it. Yeah, go ahead.
Dutchman is amazing. It's a Leroy Jones play before Jones had changed his name to Amiri Barak. He was a beat poet. He had edited really influential poetry journals. He had written the first books in English on jazz, and he became a playwright. And Dutchman was his first or second play. And it's about a young black man who gets on the subway in New York, and this white woman who's kind of stalking him gets on the subway. And it's a seduction that plays out on the screen until she turns on him, and then he explodes. And it becomes a horror movie in the last 5 minutes. I mean, it's just a brilliant, scathing piece of cinema. And they have to shoot it in London because no American studio and no subway in New York would allow them to shoot it. They have to recreate a subway platform and car in a studio in London. And it's got a score by John Barry, the guy who was scoring, you know, Born Free and the Bond films and so on. It's just an amazing movie. 1 hour long.
And I'm just showing Joe that you can get it on Amazon here. Though. You have to like it a lot.
Well,
if you get it new, it's $502.
Yeah.
Used very good is $280.
I tracked down through a friend of mine who did an interview with one of the performers for Shock Express magazine. I tracked down the lead actress. Shirley Knight, thank you. And she put me in touch with the widow of the producer. And they granted me permission to show the film at Appalachian State University down in Boone, North Carolina. And we double billed it with permission of Image 10, Russ Streiner. We contacted him. We showed Dutchman and Night of the Living Dead back to back.
Wow. Wow.
And the reason for wanting to show them back to back is they were both released within a year by the same company, Continental, which was Walter Reed's company, right? And Dutchman hardly got any play because, like Roger Corman's The Intruder, you know, this isn't a commercial proposition to show a race-baiting, hate-mongering movie in a theater. And it was only an hour long, right? And that just killed it. And then Night of the Living Dead, a year later, comes out from the same company. And part of my fascination is the last sequence in Dutchman, when they're carrying the black character off the subway car, is almost replicated by that still shot of Ben.
Oh, and Night of the Living Dead,
St. Jones lifted onto the bonfire. And I'm like, oh, my God. Romero never saw the movie. I mean, I asked Romero, I asked the people at Image 10. They'd never seen it. But sometimes these coincidences, you know, coincidental things happen in cinema history, and it's real. You know, there is something that was happening there. Three other films I'll mention, two short films. I first saw David Lynch's Alphabet, his short film from 67.
Oh, yeah, sure.
At a student Kodak film festival I was part of, because I was one of those kids that had an 8mm camera and I was making my own wonky stop motion clay movies and stuff. And Alphabet was something Kodak had picked up for this student film festival, and they showed it again and again. So that was my exposure to David Lynch. And Kenneth Anger's, I'm going to pronounce this wrong because my French is poor, Ode à l'Artifice from 1953, the one with the midget woman walking around all the fountains in Paris or somewhere in France. Those are my two underground films I saw. And around the same week, I also saw Peter Watkins' The War Game.
Which we just talked about
on our
last show. With Alex Cox, yes.
Okay, then I'll leave it there. I mean, The War Game, you know, it was shown by an anti-nuclear group at our high school, and it was scathing stuff.
Yep.
And,
yeah.
It's also the first mockumentary I think I saw, other than that weird fake news clip about harvesting spaghetti off of tree limbs that they showed on some April Fool's news show in the early 60s. The War Game made me understand the power of mockumentaries.
Hard to think of it as a mockumentary, but for sure. Yeah, it's an amazing film. But Stephen, we are run out of time here. Do you have one more you want to slam us with on the way out the door? Or?
I'll just list them.
Okay.
2001, Colossus, Corbin Project.
Yes.
Night of the Living Dead.
Yes.
Paul Bartel's Secret Cinema.
Oh.
Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch, and that was, I could name all the Peckinpah movies after that. The next big one for me was Donald Kamel and Nicholas Roeg with Performance, and then Nicholas Roeg with Walkabout, Don't Look Now, and The Man Who Fell to Earth. Alan Moore was a huge Nicholas Roeg fan as well.
Sure. And
when we started on Swamp Thing, you know, that first story we did together, The Anatomy Lesson, is pretty much our Roeg film.
Oh, wow.
It's structured, you know, if you revisit it, thinking about, you know, Don't Look Now, the Nicholas Roeg film, I think you'll see, and reading Alan's script was just hair-raising for me, because I recognized Alan was doing in 23 pages of commercial comics the closest thing I'd ever seen to what Nicholas Roeg did to me with his movies. Oh, so, wow. Another underground, Stan Brakhage's The Act of Seeing with One's Own Eyes, which he shot in a major metropolitan morgue. And it's a procession of autopsies, but it's not the gore aspect. It's not a gore film. It's a poet with a camera meditating on death for an hour. That film blew my mind. The Devils. And then the big three of the 70s, I'll leave you with Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yep.
That's the closest I ever saw to a nightmare other than a racer hit. And I saw it when it opened. Little theater in Morrisville, Vermont called the Bijou, which is still there. And there were four of us in the theater, and Texas Chainsaw blew our mind. And as we're leaving the theater, a school bus pulled up. The local basketball team had just won, and they were celebrating by going to Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Walter Hill's Hard Times.
Oh, yeah.
And finally, David Cronenberg, The Brood. That impacted me like no movie I'd ever seen before or since.
And which you have, a great way to segue out, you've got a book coming out about, correct?
Yeah, 600 pages plus on The Brood.
Wow.
Wow.
Take it, but,
when is that coming out?
It's coming out from Electric Dreamhouse and PS Publications in Britain, and they're proofing the PDF right now, and they're shooting to get it out April, May. So it'll be out pretty soon.
Wonderful. Right. Wonderful. Well, listen, thank you so very much for coming in. It is such a thrill walking through your brain with you.
Hey. These are the movies that made me. So you asked for it.
Oh, that's right.
We asked for it.
Yes, we did. Stephen, thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave.
Josh, Joe, it's been an honor.
Oh, it's been a pleasure having you, sir. Take care.
Sorry for overtime.
No,
it's okay. Okay, he'll cut it.
Yes. We'll cut all of Joe's stuff out. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Our show was recorded in beautiful downtown Burbank. The official podcast of TrailersFromHell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for The Movies That Made Me.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.